Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Big Brother, 2 + 2 = 5, the memory hole, truth isn't truth. Sound familiar? Well, they're from George Orwell's dark masterpiece, 1984. Okay, not all of those phrases are from 1984. That last one, truth isn't truth, well, that's from the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. So it's real and it's recent, which shows you the timelessness and predictive power of Orwell's novel. Published 70 years ago this Saturday, 1984 serves as a warning against absolute power of all kinds, against the manipulation of language, against the loss of independent thought. Published in 1949, critics thought the book might lose its relevance after the fall of communism. But here we are, 70 years later, with global authoritarianism on the rise and fake news and even the manipulation of that term itself all tearing at the fabric of democracy. So this hour on Point, lessons from 1984 for 2019. And you can join us. When did you first read 1984? Have you reread it recently? What resonates about this book for you? What are the sources of doublethink today? And what if Big Brother isn't government, but technology that we are welcoming into our lives? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today from London is Jean Seaton, director of the Orwell Foundation, which promotes George Orwell's work and awards the Orwell Prize for Political Writing. She's also the official historian of the BBC and a professor of media history at the University of Westminster. Jean Seaton, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Also,
nice to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. Also with us from Bloomington, Indiana, is Michael Sheldon, English professor at Indiana State University and author of the book Orwell, The Authorized Biography. Michael Sheldon, welcome to you as well.
Good to be with you.
So let me just start briefly and ask both of you the same question, but Jean, I'll let you answer first. How relevant is 1984 today, almost exactly 70 years after its publication?
Rather weirdly, it feels very relevant in different places. I think it's never actually not been relevant. It was used to be relevant in North Korea and authoritarian places. I remember going to Burma about 8 years ago and it felt relevant before. But now it feels rather shockingly and alarmingly relevant much closer to home. So we used to see it as something that was a warning to us comfortable people in social democracies, and now it feels a little bit more alarming than that, which is why I think so many people have turned to reading it again.
And Michael Sheldon, how would you answer that?
He's gotten more relevant. It's amazing how a man who lived and wrote his book in the 1930s and 40s would see so far ahead into our digital future. I think that's the brilliance of what's been enduring, is the notion that we've shifted from the old-fashioned thing where if you want to play music, you watch a record turn on a turntable, to now you just have a file. And in a digital world like that, you find it much easier to do what Orwell talks about in 1984, slip things down the memory hole, airbrush things, disappear whole histories and facts, and to distort them in ways that are a lot easier to do in a digital world than they were in the old analog world. Mm. So we're living in George Orwell's world now, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to be mindful that perhaps not everyone listening is an obsessive reader of George Orwell the way we might be. So Jean, could you just kind of briefly give us a little synopsis of the story that Orwell tells in 1984?
Ah. Yes. It's projected into a future in which a slippery, slidey, authoritarian dictatorship has taken over, which survives by always fighting. The world is divided into three blocks and you're always fighting one of them, but that slips around, you make coalitions. So at the sort of international scale, the world is divided into these blocks, and you survive locally, nationally, by hating somebody else. And secondly, there's a regime whose intent is to completely reduce English to a very few numbers of words, so that while you do that, you eradicate thoughts and feelings. You make it impossible for people to think new thoughts. And thirdly, it's a regime which is based on it's partly based on where it comes from, we'll get on around to, but it's based on a complete vigilance over every detail of people's lives and their feelings. There's an attempt to eradicate proper, loving, fulfilling sexual relationships, so that feels very modern, and replace them by something much more odd. Mm. And so the story is of Winston Smith, the last man in Europe, who's sort of Orwell, but not quite. John can do this better than me. And he's a rebellion. I mean, against all of this, he becomes more rebellious over the course of the book. And he believes that Big Brother, or at least an agent of Big Brother, mm-hmm. so it's a bit like a spy thriller, actually, is in fact overturnable, and that you can create a private space. So he goes off and has a love affair. And in fact, he is always being watched, and he is discovered, and his girlfriend are discovered, yeah. and they are both tortured. And he is made, we think, though we might come back that, to finally, under torture, give up his own belief in reality. So the final torture is, does 2 + 2 = 4, or does it equal 5? And so the final thing to go is apparently his own internal mm-hmm. state. So it sounds pretty gloomy, but there are romantic... I mean, there are some hopeful bits. We might get onto that.
Yeah.
And it's capped at the end with something that makes you think that perhaps that future doesn't happen.
I don't know if that's... we will get to that, because I do actually want to ask both of you.
It doesn't sound exciting when you say it like that. But I mean, I just have to say it's a very short, very intense book for all sorts of reasons. And in that sense, it's completely unputdownable. I mean, it's the book you consume in a go.
Right. Well, so if I may, and I just want to, the three of us, we've picked individual readings or excerpts from 1984 to share with each other and listeners this hour. And if I may, I'd like to just offer mine, which comes right at the top of the book, right at the very beginning of 1984. Because, Gene, as you're saying, one of the reasons why it's unputdownable is not just the story that Orwell tells, but the manner in which he tells it. He just mm-hmm. grabs you right from the top. And the book opens, of course, with the very famous line, "It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13, right? And then Orwell goes on to write, "The hallway smelt of boiled cabbage and old rag mats. At one end of it, a colored poster, too large for indoor display, had been tacked to the wall. It depicted simply an enormous face, more than a meter wide, the face of a man about 45, with a heavy black mustache and ruggedly handsome features. Winston made for the stairs. It was no use trying the lift. Even at the best of times, it was seldom working. And at present, the electric current was cut off during daylight hours. It was part of the economy drive in preparation for Hate Week. The flat was 7 flights up, and Winston, who was 39 and had a varicose ulcer above his right ankle, went slowly, resting several times on the way. On each landing, opposite the lift shaft, the poster with the enormous face gazed from the wall. It was one of those pictures which are so contrived that the eyes follow you when you move. Big Brother is watching you," the caption beneath it ran. Michael Sheldon, even all these years later, I first read 1984 in high school. The opening still gives me chills to this day. How did Orwell do that?
It probably should give you chills. It's the notion that you're always being watched. I like to say to my students that if I followed them around all day taking notes of what they were doing, eventually someone would call the police on me. But I say, your cell phones do that now every day. They track everything you're doing. So we've let ourselves slip into that very world that Orwell described, of a place where all surveillance is possible, and surveillance from many different levels. And I think that should be shocking to people. It's what Orwell saw in our future.
Jean Seaton, do you have a response to that?
And I think that's true. I think we've one of the interesting things is that in Orwell, Big Brother is a sort of a face. We might come back to that. And it's a sort of, may or may not exist, we don't really know, but he's a sort of person. But we've now, one of the themes of the novel is about complicity, about the way in which people agree to their own delusion. Do you know what I mean? They willingly give up. And that sense that there's no gesture, there's no thing you can buy that somebody doesn't know something about you. There is no pleasure you can take that doesn't involve the internet or where you are. So we have absolutely been complicit in something that may be used for purposes, and clearly is in some societies already, actually, being used for purposes that we wouldn't have agreed to. And we wouldn't have agreed to all of that stuff even being sold if we'd have known, if we'd have understood. But it looked convenient. So I think the easy complicity of us in the situation Michael's just described feels very important.
Well, we are talking about the 70th anniversary of George Orwell's dystopian masterpiece, 1984, and what lessons the novel has for us in 2019. We want to hear from you. Have you recently reread 1984? Does it seem to hit a little too close to home? And if so, why? And we'll head into a quick break with David Bowie's single, 1984, from his 1974 album, Diamond Dogs. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the fact that on June 8th, 1949, George Orwell's masterpiece 1984 was first published. So it is approaching its 70th anniversary. And what lessons do we have today in 2009 to draw from 1984? And of course, one of the central ideas in Orwell's 1984 is this idea of language and thought and how to control both, through an element called newspeak that Orwell introduces in his novel. So this is a scene from a 1954 BBC adaptation of the novel, and Winston Smith, played by Peter Cushing, asks a fellow party member, Syme, played by Donald Pleasence, about his work creating the language of newspeak.
I can see we'll have a busy time. It becomes compulsory, learning all the new words your department's invented for us.
We're not only inventing words, we're destroying them. Scores of them, thousands every day. It's beautiful.
Beautiful?
Well, simplicity out, of course. Oh, for one example, just take the word good. If you have that, what need for the word bad? Ungood does just as well. Then instead of a string of vague extra words like excellent and splendid, you have plus good, or stronger still, double plus good. In Newspeak, the whole notion of goodness and badness will be covered by six words. In reality, by only one word.
It's from a 1954 adaptation of Orwell's 1984. I'm joined today by Jean Seaton, director of the Orwell Foundation. She's with us from London. And Michael Sheldon is with us. He's an English professor at Indiana State University and author of Orwell, The Authorized Biography. And Jean and Michael, I really want to spend some time exploring this aspect of the book with you, because we will talk more about surveillance and authoritarianism. But to me, it seems as if one of the central ideas that Orwell is trying to put forward, and one of the reasons why this novel will never lose its relevance, regardless of what our political moment is because he's talking about how our ability as individuals or as societies to think freely, to think openly, to engage truthfully with the world can be controlled and manipulated through the control of language. So Michael Sheldon, this is something that Orwell cared about deeply for his entire life. But what was it about his experience that led him to focus so strongly on this idea of thought and language?
Well, think about it. The Oxford English Dictionary has, roughly speaking, 500,000 words. The object of Newspeak is to reduce it, and Orwell gives this figure, to around 900 words. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about taking a language of enormous richness and variety and reducing it to the point where you can barely say anything. You can't really put together a very coherent thought. And he ran into that sort of thing not only in his writing, but also working at the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, for 2 years during the war, where many words were censored, many words were not allowed because of wartime censorship. In fact, some of his broadcasts were done sitting in front of a kill switch, in which at any moment he could be shut off because he was saying something forbidden. It's ironic today that the entrance to the BBC has a statue of Orwell and a quote above it carved into the stone. If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they do not want to hear.
Right. Gene Seaton.
That's the big problem.
Yeah. I was just going to say, Gene Seaton, is that a message that people still want to hear these days?
I think that his concern with the emaciation, the impoverishment of language came from a longer experience than just at the BBC. It came from particularly observing what happened around reporting of the Spanish Civil War, when he found that he understood he'd gone to fight against fascists, and he found himself fighting for a very tiny group of, in a very split left. But he found that the newspaper reports from people who he had believed to be more comradely to him on the left told lies, and he observed Russian control of communism, and people like Arthur Koestler, his friends, also told very strong stories. So I think that the notion of the emaciation of language also came from observing the way in which fascism and communism destroyed the capacity to think and didn't want independent thinking. I'm obviously, as a BBC historian, I often throw dirt at them, but I don't think that was the main experience. Indeed, he wrote a letter when he left the BBC saying, nobody's ever stopped me saying what I want to think, and it was a war. So I think BBC censorship was one little bit. I think bureaucracy was one little bit. But I think his real sense of language was that that ideologues, mm-hmm. both from the right and the left, people who've got a vision, try and make reality fit that vision. And to do so, they have to squirrel with words.
Right. So this is such an interesting and important point. Michael Sheldon, let me turn back to you. Because as Jean said, Orwell's concern was that, and I'm paraphrasing what you just said here, Jean, but ideologues from both the right and the left, in order to advance their vision, squirrel with those words. So we can focus on how that plays out in political life. But I'm wondering if we're seeing it today also in other realms. I'm thinking, what would Orwell think about occasionally online mobs might go after some writers of young adult novels and say, you know, you've written something in that novel that we object to, so self-censor it. I mean, is that markedly different than the kind of language control that Orwell was concerned with?
No, it's still a form of censorship, and quite right that the Spanish Civil War gave him a real taste of that. He got it almost everywhere he went because he was so committed to telling what he saw as the objective truth. And he got tired of being lied to in so many different places in his life and in so many different experiences. So when he saw other people try to suppress the truth, when he saw others try to censor anyone, he formulated that notion that you don't really have freedom of speech unless you can tell people what they don't want to hear. It's still a revolutionary command, because try starting that today with your boss or anyone else. A lot of people don't want to hear certain things.
Well, Michael,
I think, if you looked at freedom is slavery, you know, there's these great slogans in the book: freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength,
war is peace.
Yeah. That sense that you can just impose on things a kind of willed version of reality. I think that's one of his big battles. I mean, he's very dedicated to trying to understand reality.
Right.
Really?
Well, so Michael Sheldon, I would love if you could actually read to us your selected passage from 1984, because it's exactly along the lines of conversation that we're having right now about how Orwell writes about the party's control over human thought in the novel. So could you read your selection for us?
Sure. The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command. His heart sank as he thought of the enormous power arrayed against him, the case with which any party intellectual would overthrow him in debate, the subtle arguments which he would not be able to understand, much less answer. And yet he was in the right. They were wrong, and he was right. The obvious, the silly, and the true had got to be defended. Truisms are true. Hold on to that. The solid world exists. Its laws do not change. Stones are hard. Water is wet. Objects unsupported fall towards the earth's center. With the feeling that he was speaking to O'Brien, and also that he was setting forth an important axiom, he wrote, "Freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. If that is granted, all else follows."
Wow, That's Michael Sheldon reading an excerpt from George Orwell's 1984. We should say that when he's saying that Winston Smith is writing, he's writing secretly, right, in his own diary.
He is indeed.
Michael, go on.
Yeah, he's writing what he hopes will be a record of all of this that might survive. But, of course, the whole point of the Big Brother's regime is to make sure that nothing survives. He kind of got this idea from Stalin's habit of erasing people from photographs once they fell out of favor, and of course the whole notion of the purge trials. So he had this idea that history might disappear, facts might disappear, simply because they became inconvenient. Mm.
Gene, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that his first sort of Winston Smith's first sort of transgressive act is to go and get himself a diary, which he tries to write round the corner from the telescreen, which can see him. And so he tries to compose himself and out of the eyes of the state. And so that private world, I think, is a very important part of what it is that you're trying to protect from all sorts of pressures. I mean, in the book, it's a sort of, as it were, a malign big state. Because that was Orwell's experience in the 1930s. I mean, the book is the product of all of his life, really, of hundreds of thousands of words of writing and thinking and slowly getting towards something. But he had that. But if you look at it now, I think it lives on precisely because, in a way, although it's very particular, it's talking about being a person and a person in a society in a way that you can still relate to.
Mm. Well, you know, in addition, this excerpt that you've picked, Michael, let's go back to the beginning line, the first line in the excerpt, where Orwell writes, "The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command." Now, this line, it got a resurgence on social media not all that long ago when President Donald Trump, at a Veterans of Foreign Wars convention, said, just remember what you are seeing and what you are reading is not what's happening. So, I mean, Mike, is that too close a comparison?
No, because it's our political way now to create our own information and purvey it as though it's everyone's information, and to pretend that we have our own set of facts and the other side has another set of facts. It is exactly, I know this is ancient history to bring up the Spanish Civil War, but it is exactly that grounding in that war where factions were against each other to such a degree that you could be in favor one day and murdered the next day by your supposed friends. And I think he got that sensation there that at some point you have to hold on to an objective reality. You have to say, as Orwell said very powerfully, I was shot in the throat for this war. He was in the Spanish Civil War. I got a bullet wound in my throat. I can feel it. Who the hell are you to tell me what to think? I was willing to surrender my life for this struggle. So he had to hold on to the facts as he knew them. Otherwise, they would be distorted out of all reality.
Right. And I think
He's very fascinated by irrationality. He knows that irrationality, those lies, as it were, those distortions of reality, are what in the 1930s were winning. And his response to that, I think one of the things in the book, there's a sort of golden country. But also in his life, he said somewhere, you know, as long as I shall live, I'll enjoy trivial pleasures. He liked growing flowers. He liked growing things. He wrote the book actually against a really beautiful background in Scotland. This is really profound stuff. He's saying there are scientific truths, and if we don't hang on to those, we will go mad. Mm. And that feels that at the moment, science feels under challenge in a lot of ways.
Mm. You know, this is the thing that exactly makes Orwell a hero of both the right and the left. His stalwart stand for independence of thought, of reality, of truth. But it seems as if both on the far right and the far left, or perhaps all of us as human beings, because aided by technology, are in a world where, because we can essentially construct our own digital realities, we are not doing at all what Orwell wishes that we did, which is hold on to fundamental truths. But on that point, I just want to actually allow some of our callers to come in. So let's go to Juan, who's calling from Sarasota, Florida. Juan, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'm really enjoying the conversation. I was born in 1949. And I read 1984 in like the late 70s. I said, I got to read this and see what's going to happen in 1984. So I read the book, and 1984 came around, and none of the stuff in the book happened. So I said, huh, but it's all happening now. It's just happening a few years later, you know. So 1984 is 2019, should have been a more accurate title. A couple of comments about 1984. I don't remember anything about religion being a part of the story. Mm-hmm. You know, the religion had like no role. It was kind of like a communistic like very much impacted by the Second World War. So religion was really not an element. And now religion is huge and getting bigger all the time. And religious tensions and differences are a huge part of the conversation now. And the other element was the element of constant war,
right,
which is also something that's happening now. There was always a war going on, and you had to be against it, or you were not patriotic, or you had to be for the, you know, each side had its own.
Yeah. So well, Juan, let me just take it back from you. I'm so sorry to interrupt you. It's just that we have a couple of minutes before we have to get to our next break, and I wanted to allow Michael Sheldon to respond to what Juan was saying about religion not being overtly or at all in 1984. Why is that?
Oh, faith and sex are dangerous, aren't they? And Big Brother recognizes that, or his regime does, mm-hmm. that if you give people the chance to exercise their faith, whatever it is, or certainly their sexual impulses, you lose control of them. You need to have control of those two private areas of their lives in order to have total control. And that's really what he's after. He's trying to break down individual will, and that's certainly a place you'd want to start.
Right. And Jean Seton, what do you have to say about that?
Yeah, I think that religion isn't there because it would have been an alternative
source of independence, and the religion, as in communism or in fascism, he was looking at regimes that repressed religion, but in a way, the party is religion. So I think the party's ideological control over what you do and what you believe is like some religion, but it doesn't have the independence of a spiritual faith. This is an anti-spiritual world.
Well, we are talking about George Orwell's 1984. It was published 70 years ago this Saturday. What lessons does Orwell's great novel have for us here in 2019? Who is Big Brother today? Want to hear what your answer is to that question, and we'll head into the break with Rage Against the Machine's 1999 song, Testify, which invokes the Orwellian phrase, "Who controls the past, controls the future." This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the 70th anniversary of George Orwell's dystopian classic 1984. It turns 70 on Saturday, and yet it seems to have deep resonance now, even in 2019. And we want to hear from you if you think that way. Not just if you think that way, because I don't want just affirmative calls if you disagree with us. I'm joined today by Jean Seaton. She's director of the Orwell Foundation. She's also official historian of the BBC and professor of media history at the University of Westminster. She's with us from London. Michael Sheldon joins us as well from Bloomington, Indiana. He's an English professor at Indiana State University, and author of Orwell, The Authorized Biography. And Jean, there's something that you said earlier that I want to circle back to a little bit. And I want to do that by listening to the opening scene of the film adaptation of 1984, which came out in 84. And in this scene, it depicts the daily ritual called the 2 Minutes Hate, where members of the outer party watch a film about enemies of the state and express their hatred. And here's what it sounds like.
There is a cancer, an evil tumor, growing, spreading in our midst. Shout, shout, shout out his name.
The crowd there shouting Goldstein because one of the enemies of the state is named Emmanuel Goldstein. So, Jean Seaton, what is it about Orwell's depiction of the way the passions of an entire society of humans can be so easily aroused? What is it about that that still seems so trenchant today?
Well, Orwell always writes himself into everything, one of the extraordinary things about the way which it's written is that the Winston Smith person goes in to the 2 Minutes Hate, which is a sort of regular way of exhorting people to believe the Big Brother more and to raise their feelings, and he goes into it with some hostility, and then he feels that he is attracted to it. He feels the effect of it on himself. So that's really a very interesting aspect of the way in which Orwell always goes to the most uncomfortable places. Why it feels to me really terribly pertinent is the way in which, open quotes, the media, we used to think about the old heritage media, but communities of people you are with and who you would like to be seen as admirable within, and honourable within, can be moved beyond what feels reasonable to really extreme actions and views and hostilities and impoliteness and horriblenesses. And that feels a bit like agreeing with lots of people online that somebody is awful and really being abusive in a way that you wouldn't be face to face.
Are you talking about social media mobs, essentially?
Yes, yes. And we've just in Britain been through, we're still in the middle of a horrible thing called Brexit, which God knows what it means. I've no idea what it means. Nobody knows what it means. But it's certainly produced, it's legitimised British people quite often being very unpleasant to each other and not listening to each other. So not listening and being roused to feelings rather irrationally that you wouldn't be if you thought about it feels like a very potent aspect of contemporary life that he was nailing down in the 2 minutes hate, which in a way came from the way in which the Soviet Union and German propaganda had worked. So he's working from the real life and he's working from propaganda in Britain that tried to make you brace up and stand up. So he's got real information around, but why it feels pertinent is because it's about belonging to a group of people and therefore losing control of your feelings.
That's right.
In ways that you wouldn't do if you were just sitting down with your mum having a cup of tea.
Right. Well, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Ethan, who's calling from Cumberland, Maine. Ethan, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just calling because listening to this, it really makes me think the interesting thing about our modern age is that even with things like Sri Lanka, Myanmar, the Uyghur population in China, in the Western world, we've been handing over all of our data and our control to private companies like Facebook, yeah, Google, Amazon. And these companies have actually, they willfully show that they do control our behavior and that they can manipulate how we feel by changing their algorithms and changing the messaging to us. And I just was just wondering your thoughts on that.
Right. So, Ethan, thank you so much for your call. So, Michael Sheldon, Big Brother not being political, but rather commercial, private tech.
Well, this is another one of Orwell's great insights, that the real motivator here is power, the acquisition of power and the holding of power. And power can take many different forms, commercial, bureaucratic, government, whatever. But Orwell saw how power fed these huge organizations and how that caused those organizations to twist themselves into all kinds of manipulations of data and of facts and other things in order to serve their purposes and sustain their power. And we can see this just in so many places today. Mm.
Well, Gene, you're the remainder of We Trio here that hasn't had a chance to share an excerpt from 1984, and yours is particularly interesting as well. I was wondering if you might read it to us.
Yes, it's Winston Smith is remembering, which you have to remember is a challenged thing in 1984. He has a dream, and he's remembering that in some way his mother and sister sacrificed their lives to him, and he's just looking back to the dream life, and this is the quote. The thing that now suddenly struck Winston was that his mother's death, nearly 30 years ago, had been tragic and sorrowful in a way that was no longer possible. Tragedy, he perceived, belonged to the ancient time, to a time when there was still privacy, love and friendship, and when the members of families stood by one another without needing to know the reason. His mother's memory tore at his heart because she had died loving him when he was too young and selfish to love her in return, and because somehow he did not remember how. She had sacrificed herself to a conception of loyalty that was private and unalterable. Such things, he saw, could not happen today. Today there was fear, hatred and pain, but no dignity of emotion, no deep or complex sorrows. All this he seemed to see in the large eyes of his mother and his sister, looking up at him through green water, hundreds of fathoms down and still sinking.
Hmm. That's Gene Seaton reading an excerpt from George Orwell's 1984. Why is it that you wanted to highlight this passage?
Partly because I found it moving.
Yeah.
And partly because it really stunned me. It really struck me when I reread it. You know, complex emotions, deep and complex sorrows. These are things that culture and our lives should hold on to. And one worries that it's easy to hate and that a lot of feelings come, perhaps as they always have done, sort of secondhand from celebrities, and that one's capacity, that describes something about one's, that something alarming that we need to hang on to, which is, you know, difficult, nasty, not just to be said, not just to be shared, not just to be not to be done away with, or not need, doesn't need to always hang out. You know, it that sorrow and how we think about guilt and shame and sorrow and grief, because those are all words in this bit. It is something that we may be in danger of losing. And one looks around public life and you could almost tick off people you admire who you think, well, yes, I know that there are private sorrows there.
Right.
And they are experienced in a real and, I mean, even Mrs. May, known as Maybot, one watched her today, the British Prime Minister. She's a hopeless Prime Minister, but there's no doubt that she has private sorrows.
Mm. Well, there's everything in that line that you read, that today there were fear, hatred and pain, but no dignity of emotion, no deep or complex sorrows. Oh, let me just see if I can sneak one more call in here. John is calling from Boynton Beach, Florida. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Really interesting conversation that you guys are having about a book that I absolutely adore, and I actually, as an English teacher, actually teach. And one of the things that you've been talking about that is not usually discussed so much and overlooked when the book is discussed is the destruction of language.
Mm-hmm.
And how significant that is. As a teacher, I have, and I hope the professor would, you know, comment on this as well. Every year, it seems that the richness of vocabulary and specificity of language is diminishing. And to go back to your question that you asked, who is Big Brother? It not only is it government, as revealed with like the Edward Snowden revelations, but to echo one of the last callers, it's the it's Google,
yeah,
and social media and Amazon. To also go back to the clip from the movie and the quote you brought in with his conversation with the linguist Syme, is the conclusion of that conversation, which is most haunting, is that when he says we won't even be able to have this conversation, that the language of dissent will be impossible because people can't even think it.
Well, John, thank you so much for your call. Michael and Jean, we have 4 minutes left. It's gone by far too quickly. And I do want to open the door a little bit to if there are messages of hope in George Orwell's 1984. And Michael, let me start with you, because I must shamefully admit that it wasn't until yesterday, in the multiple times that I have read this book that I love so much, it wasn't until yesterday that I read the appendix. And that's because another writer that when I was researching and preparing for today said there is a message of hope in the appendix to 1984. Michael, what is going on there? Why is that important?
Well, I think Orwell's attempt to analyze what it is he's trying to set forward gives us some hope, partly because it isn't just that the analysis is so good.
It's an analysis of newspeak, whether we should say.
It's the understanding that the book itself is a kind of monument to what he thinks may disappear unless we hang on to it. He was once told to several people how good one of his books is, and afterwards he turned away and said, but no one said it was beautifully written. And I think part of what we've discovered here talking today is how beautifully written this book is. Mm-hmm. It is itself a testament to Orwell's enduring power. It is a testament to the enduring power of language and of storytelling. The book says what the future can be if we choose to follow it and hear its message.
Well, Gene, I'm not even sure how to read the appendix. I'm not sure whose voice it's written in, because it talks about that the intent was to have newspeak be the language for everyone by the year 2050. But the way it's described, is it that never happened? I'm not sure.
It doesn't matter. It means that the testimony you've just read and the mind you have just been beside, even though it's been destroyed, at least a record of it has in fact survived. That's a real history. In lots of ways, the book's about how you find, how you preserve the possibility of real history. So suddenly, in this thing that's really written like a government report, actually, you realise that it has survived. But I think the other thing that makes it a hopeful book is he's not saying this has to happen. He's saying, kind of, stand up, beware, rise to arms. You can do something about it. He doesn't write it to make you miserable. He writes it to warn you and arm you.
Yeah. Well, and Michael, he sort of writes in this appendix, one of the limits of newspeak was that in no way by design could it capture the complexity of human thought as we have in our current language. And he points to, of all things, the best known passage from the Declaration of Independence. I just thought that was absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's a war of words and ideas, almost literally. It's an attempt to claim the high ground for language against those who would diminish it and who would use it again for the purposes of their own power. And that can't be allowed to happen. Anyone who reads the book and reads it thoughtfully can see that.
Gene, it will forever be a heartbreak in me, and I'm sure with every other Orwell fan, to know that this was his last book. That Orwell died, only several months of tuberculosis after the publication of 1984. One simply will never stop wondering. I won't stop wondering what more he could have written. And he was only 50 years old when he died.
Well, that.
Or something. 47, actually. I don't have the right
47, but it doesn't matter. He died young.
Yeah.
And the book is written so brilliantly, partly because I don't know that he knew he was dying. You're alive till you die. But he knew that he was running out. So it's got all of that grasping onto, everything that's beautiful in it.
Well, Gene Seaton, director of the Orwell Foundation and official historian of the BBC, professor of media history at the University of Westminster, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And Michael Sheldon, English professor at Indiana State University and author of Orwell, the authorized biography. Michael Sheldon, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
It was fun. Thank you.
And as we end this hour celebrating the 70th anniversary of Orwell's 1984, we'll close with the 2003 song by Radiohead, inspired by that party slogan, 2 plus 2 equals 5. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title, and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.